404-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, I don't know how they're able to pick out the right song at the right time. How did they know we were going to talk about Ukraine? But we are. And Sandy, there's a conversation as, you know, people are starving different parts of the world. We may not be aware of it in our country. But the shortage of grain coming from Ukraine and Russia has caused a major stir in different parts of the world, and people are going hungry just as they predicted would happen. And many, I guess, I didn't think that there was any way possible that there would be a decision or brokered decision between Ukraine and Russia. They're battling each other, you know, tooth and nail, that they would be willing to sit down and have this conversation about allowing the grain to move.
Well, I think, you know, there is this problem that the starvation, which much of it would occur in the northern portion of Africa,
right,
and that it has a starvation has an impact on refugees and a destabilizing effect on outward migrations and migrations of people. Turkey frequently finds itself right in the middle of that, because it really is at a crossroads for people to movement of people,
right,
from the place of starvation to someplace else. So Turkey has an extreme interest in avoiding that outcome. Turkey is a fairly influential country. It's Erdogan has kept up his ties. They're part of NATO, but he's also tight with the Soviet. With Russia. And so he's in a position to have conversations. And I think he has impressed Putin with the fact that there would be a destabilizing effect on Turkey and on portions of the world that Russia does care about as the result of starvation. And so as a result of the conversations, apparently Russia has said that they will allow for the movement of grain in and out of Ukrainian ports. But there's a price for that, and one of the prices for that is that Ukraine would remove the mines that they have placed along their coast and in and around protecting their ports to keep the Russian Navy from being in a position to make a naval assault on Ukraine. And so that's really the sticking point. Ukraine has indicated, I guess, that they're willing to sign on to this. It's going to be signed on by Russia, Ukraine, and the UN. And the UN will be a watch force to, I guess, make sure that the promises are kept. Russia's promise is that they will not launch a naval assault as the result of the removal of these landmines. But I have heard as well spokesmen for Ukraine voicing skepticism, like, in this time of war, how can we trust that,
right,
Russia won't actually use the advantage that's being created by the removal of these landmines? And so we'll see. But it looks like they've been able to reach agreement. The fact that they've reached agreement might open some hope that there could be conversations between the parties. So far, both Russia and Ukraine have agreed that Ukraine has been unwilling to have talks with Russia since April. Russia's been accusing Ukraine of being unwilling to talk, and Ukraine has said, we are unwilling to talk. Russia has said they don't think talks would be very useful at this point, but that seems to be a statement that would suggest that they're willing to talk, and maybe the usefulness.
But the civilian targets that they keep.
What we read is about civilian targets, but civilian targets might be collateral damage, and whether they've been the absolute target, or, you know, when you're in artillery war and you're not using smart weapons, the things that get hit can be collateral to actual targets. The other thing that the Russians would claim is that these civilian targets, for instance, shopping centers, have become used as refuges and hiding places for the military, right? So when you're hiding soldiers in a shopping center, is it any longer a civilian target, or is it a military target? And this is what happens in warfare. The people making the attack would argue that that's a place where the military is being hidden. Maybe they're just thinking it might be that they're hidden there. Maybe they know they're hidden there. But so in warfare, you end up with this kind of thing happening frequently. And so you know, has Russia decided to move to civilian targets? It's not exactly easy to tell.
So, Sandy, let's go back to again the conversation about opening up and allowing the grain to move. But at the same time, there's this conversation about the U.S. may send fighter jets. That, to me, could prevent the movement. Why Russia would say, okay, we're going to make a deal and allow the grain to move.
Well, it's interesting. Because 3 months ago, the United States and Biden specifically nixed the notion of sending American-made fighter jets to Poland so that Poland could send MiG fighter jets in its arsenal to Ukraine. And we nixed that because we thought it would be a destabilizing escalation of the conflict. Are we really going to do it now, or are we really just talking a destabilizing kind of rhetoric in response to Russia talking about it broadening its objectives in Ukraine? They're talking now about broadening their objective beyond the Donbas region. Russia's at least giving lip service to that through Lavrov and some of the other spokespeople. They're also talking about, or at least taking steps that look like they're going to formally annex portions of Ukraine that they have taken control of through the battlefield. And so these things seem to be escalations in preparation to preemption of settlement talks that might occur between the two countries, Ukraine and Russia. Because if Russia takes these things as their own, they would no longer, I suppose, be willing to negotiate over them, and the room for negotiation narrows. I think some of the reason that Russia is making these statements is to say, look, if you don't start negotiating with us, we're just going to take unilateral steps to narrow the issues upon which we would be willing to negotiate. And I think the United States conversation about sending fighter jets might be an effort to try and keep Russia from making those moves in advance of negotiations. My hope is that all of this is really just talk that will lead more efficiently and more directly to negotiations. And my hope is that we will help Zelensky believe that negotiations are the path to take.
Sandy, the fact that that Russia's invasion is expanding, they're basically leveling Ukraine wherever they are. The cost of reconstruction thus far is almost $1 trillion. $750 billion. There's chaos, civilian casualties. It's just not getting any better.
Well, the thing that worries me is that we keep seeing things like MI6, the intelligence agency for Britain. A couple of days ago, the leader of it said that he thought that Russia was running out of steam.
Reading that.
They were using munitions at such a fast rate that, day after tomorrow, sometime they're going to have to let up. They're going to have to let up on the invasion. That's all talk that suggests that we're fueling Ukraine with the notion that all they have to do is hang on a little bit longer, and Russia will run out of steam and they'll have an improved negotiating position. And meanwhile, Ukraine is suffering very material losses because it's inevitable. And so it worries me that's the kind of talk that's ongoing, because that's the talk that works against negotiation. And the kind of talk about sending planes and the rest of it, that's the kind of talk that actually leads to negotiation. So when I hear Russia talking about expanding its objectives, and when I hear the U.S. speaking in some conversation in Denver about possibly sending jets, to me that's all talk preparatory to trying to bring the other side to the negotiating table. When I hear them talking about Russia running out of steam, that seems to me to be talk that's designed to have Ukraine hang on longer.
They're talking about somewhere around 15,000 Russian troops have been killed. Even though that's a significant number of deaths, it's really a drop in the bucket to the size of their army, right?
Well, yeah, and although, 15,000 deaths in a period of months is difficult to take, that's at the rate of probably 50,000 in a year. And so that's a difficult war to sustain, and that would be a difficult war for the United States to sustain. We had 50,000 deaths in Vietnam.
Yeah, 10 years.
Over a whole bunch of years. So that's a significant loss. But the losses of Ukrainian lives, we've never seen that total brought up, but I'm confident it's at least the same.
You know, it is not just still puzzling because that this is still going on, but the fact that we haven't come close to even reaching the apex of this war yet is...
Well, I don't know quite what that means, but I don't know. I mean, if we start negotiation, it could come to an end. If we don't start negotiations, this could drag on for a very long time.
But Sandy, the negotiations have to come from the nation, I guess, that's been invaded first, right? I mean,
well, both countries have to agree to talk. My sense is that Russian wants to talk, but maybe that's because they want to talk and cement the situation as they see it. They want to have the Donbass, they want to have Mariupol and Crimea cemented as basically in the Russian control, and they want to have neutral Ukraine. I have long thought that was the likely result of the realpolitik, the hegemony of Russia, the socioeconomic political condition, the geopolitics of the region. There's so many inevitabilities associated with that kind of an outcome that causing Ukraine to resist negotiations to achieve that outcome is a little bit like asking the Ukrainians to fight to the last Ukrainian.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
Wow.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Fridays. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, just this war.
Yeah, let me. Off the air, we were talking about a calculus. Maybe it's worth talking about on the air. So there, you were reading that there are two possible outcomes out of a war, you know, and it's true. Logically, there are two. One of them is a negotiated settlement, and one of them is a party getting vanquished. Either the conqueror ultimately conquers its quest, or and the rest of the world abides by it, or the attempted conqueror is vanquished, as it happened in World War II. In this particular situation, the calculus is that Russia can either promote a settlement of this war and end up with a reduction and the end to the sanctions that have sequestered and isolated Russia from the rest of the world and has caused the Europe at least to suffer the results of the sanction, which is the increase in the price of oil and gas and commodities generally. Or Russia can decide that they're going to go all the way in this fight, and they're going to vanquish essentially Ukraine and take it, conquer it, and take it as their own, and end the war at that point, which would mean that the West would never end the sanctions. The West sanctioned Russia for the annexation of Crimea, and because Russia never backed off from that annexation in 2014, the West never backed off on the sanctions against Russia that it had imposed as the result of the Crimea annexation. So I think you can extrapolate from that and say, if there isn't a negotiated settlement, the West will attempt to maintain these sanctions permanently. Putin then has a calculus, as does the West, which is, how does the world work with permanent sanctions? Europe will have to suffer the detriment of having a permanent lack of access to the oil and gas from Russia, which will have a permanent effect on the price and availability of oil and gas to Europe. By the same token, Russia will lose access to that market, and it will lose access to for all of its exports and imports. And Russia will have to turn to the North-South alliances that we have talked about with Africa, with India, with China. So that's a calculus that's going on behind the scenes. I would say the West has probably as much to lose as Russia does in that relationship going forward, because there is a danger with the continuation permanently of the sanctions that Europe's resolve to continue those sanctions will fracture, and will end up with a fracture in the relationship within the European Union and within NATO over the sanctions. And Putin has predicted that to be the case. Putin also maybe is saying, you know what, even if that doesn't happen, Russia can be okay in the long run with just North-South alliances.
You know, though, Sandy...
So I'm just saying, both of those calculuses lead me to believe that both sides have something to gain from negotiations, and that both sides are betting for an outcome where there could be a problem. And my view is that the West might have more problems out of this than Russia might have out of a continuation of permanent sanctions and having Russia fight to the end.
Well, yeah, because in the end, it's not just those two nations, the impact of the world and what the people and the sacrifices all these other nations have to make. And at some point in time, you know, the other nations, the Western nations, are going to say, hey, you've asked us to sacrifice. We've been sacrificing. It's now starting to impact and affect our citizens.
Well, I mean, if this isolation thing spreads to China, the United States has to look itself in the mirror and realize that trying to isolate essentially Asia, India, China, portions of Africa, and the USSR from the Western economy might create a very difficult situation for the Western economy in the long run. It might put a cap on the growth rate that this economy can realize that America would be participating in. And in many ways, I think America might be shooting itself in the foot by promoting a long-term policy of isolation. And so if that's the case, then we ought to look in the mirror quickly and figure out what we ought to be doing about this. And this is Henry Kissinger kind of real politic. What is the real American interest here? What is the pragmatic thing we ought to be doing? And quite frankly, I think it suggests to me that we ought to be negotiating a peace.
So we haven't gotten there yet, I guess. Why would we as Americans not know what we really, outside of trying to exhaust some of Russia's military might, what else would be the reason?
Well, I think it's because our State Department and the people who make policy and the American people themselves have lost contact with this real politic, this pragmatic, sort of amoral form of international affairs in which we look out for what the American real interest is, and we instead drop that for this ideological talk about, you know, the Pax Americana, spreading American democracy anywhere and everywhere, and we began to believe our rhetoric. And in believing that rhetoric, it's caused us to jump the rail with respect to our real politic interest in the Ukraine. And because of that, and also because of the way we started dealing with China over Hong Kong and other issues, we're beginning to create a world which is not going to be in the real interest of America. It's going to be reflective of some Cheap talk.
So let me. So as we're moving forward with this, as this war continues, again, this goes to the three fronts that you are always talking about. This is not a front yet from the standpoint that we ourselves are directly engaged, but this is probably one of the reasons why the people, the hawks, keep saying we've got to have all of these things, because we can be right now indirectly engaged with this, but this doesn't have any major bearing on us militarily.
In a proxy war, talk is cheap, particularly in a proxy war where you're selling lots of military industrial complex goods and services to somebody else. You know, and we've shipped, what, $53 billion to Ukraine?
Yeah,
only about $8 billion of it is this military stuff. What's the other $45 million? Whose pockets are those in? You know, it worries me.
All right, got to go to break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. Friday's with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, here's another sign that we are headed towards a tough time. Home ownership slipping out of reach for Americans and in most counties. And so when you just look at where we were just at a point where people were actually, their homes were overpriced, and people were certainly paying more, and now we're at a point, and it's almost like overnight, you know, where it's all been shut down.
Well, you know, it is amazing. The median price for home in America, I think, has gone up to like $440,000.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that right there, you know, that home is out of range. For the median family income in America is $75,000. We've been talking about that before. How could a median family afford the median house, right? So you've got a family of that earns $75,000 can barely afford to buy a home that would cost $200,000,
right,
or $250,000. They can't afford a $450,000 home. So, well, first of all, you know, let's get real here. Something like only half of the families to no more than three quarters of the families in America own homes. So at least probably half of those families below the median don't own homes. So maybe the median family, maybe the median income for a family that owns a home, let's even say it's $100,000 or $110,000. How do they afford a $450,000 home? I mean, you can see with the math. I don't know what the income would have to be. I'd have to get my calculator out and spend a little time with it to figure out how much income should a family have to buy a $450,000 home, but I suspect it's $200,000.
You know, Sandy, it's...
And so that means that the median home is pretty much getting out of reach for the median group of families that would otherwise own homes. So that's an issue that's going to put a damper on the rise in home prices. You'd have to have an income rise to support it in order for it to continue to go up. What has supported the rise for a while has been the willingness of families to spend a higher percentage of their income on housing. And so we've probably come to the very uppermost reach of that capacity right now. And furthermore, The banks who have been making loans have apparently been using relatively tight lending policies. So unlike the bubble of 2008, where we had lots of people owning homes that they had no business owning, it's probably true that most of the people who own homes today can't afford them. But they're probably at the very upper reach of affording them. And so, you know, it's likely, because it's happening now in a bunch of countries around the world, home prices are going to begin to go down. They probably won't plummet like they did in 2008, but they probably are likely to taper down.
So people who couldn't afford those houses in 2008 lost them.
Yes.
And so it took until recently for the people who lost those houses never recovered those homes because they should have never had them in the first place.
Well, one of the things that could buffer families in the current situation is many of them hopefully have 30-year fixed mortgages. And if they do, then the rise in interest rates isn't going to affect them in their existing home if they don't have to refinance. So they're going to be able to stay in their existing home and pay the amount of money that they had planned on spending in their existing home, even though that existing home maybe has a rising value. But if they get out of that home and they have to go into a new home and they have to get a new mortgage, instead of paying 2.5% interest or 3% on the mortgage, they're going to pay 6% or 6.5%. That's what's going to taper the demand for housing. That's what's going to buffer this price increase. That's what could cause some price decreases. But that's a different kind of a problem than the problem in 2008.
Because of a lending institution is going to look at all of that and say, really, you're overtaxed. I mean, there's no way you're not a good bet, right?
Yeah, you're not a good bet for a mortgage, so we can't give you a mortgage at 6%. We do the math on what your monthly payments are, and you can't support it. You can't buy this house for $450. You can only spend $400. So pretty soon the bidding for the houses that come on the market goes down to reflect the monthly payments that the buyers can afford to pay in order to buy the house. That's going to taper the demand for housing. That's different than the collapse in 2008 when lots of people owned houses that they could not afford.
So median price single-family homes and condos are less affordable in the second quarter of 2022 compared to historical averages in 97% of counties across the nation. With enough data to analyze, 97% of those counties, that was up from 69% of the counties that were historically less affordable in 2021. That's a tremendous, 30%.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the very math we were talking about. So, in fact, that's a demonstration, I suppose, of the validity of what I was saying earlier, that houses are getting more expensive, interest rates going up is making them even less affordable, so that the rise in interest rates on mortgages is going to cause people to back off on their capacity.
But, Sandy, it's at the same time that rental rates have increased. And so people are caught between a rock and a hard place. I've got to pay even more for rent. I'm better off trying to own a property.
Yeah.
And
except that now the calculus for owning the property has become more difficult because of the interest rate.
So this is where people are.
If the interest rate's going to drive people into renting. I mean, the answer is that the increase in the price of houses, coupled with the increase in interest rates on mortgages, is going to make the achievement of the American dream more difficult if it isn't matched with a rapid increase in the size of the middle class as well as the income of the median family in America. And so, you know, we need a readjustment in the earnings profile of the mass population in America in order to make the American dream again as possible. Because, you know, I think Tom or somebody said, you know, it's right. The American dream has morphed from what it used to be, which was a family that could own a home, own a car, maybe own two cars, send their kids to college.
Go on vacation every year.
And that was the American dream. And now, first of all, for many people, that's not achievable. But for some people, the American dream has turned into three homes and five cars and much greater wealth than is necessary to achieve the comfortable American life.
You know, Sandy, and all of these things happening, when I keep hearing and reading about the fact that wages have been up 5% or so over for the first time, and I don't know how long the wages.
Well, real income was going up faster than inflation until inflation hit about 8% most recently. So it had gone up like 7%, but housing had gone up 25%, you know, the price of a house. So, I mean, there are some things that are racing ahead of income. And there's no question right now that the inflation is not being wage-driven, it's being shortage-driven, okay? And, you know, in the 70s, there was a lot of talk, particularly amongst the Republicans, that we had a wage price spiral and that higher wages were driving inflation, which is a way of justifying taking money out of the pockets of Tom, Dick, and Mary to stop this inflation, which is such a general economic problem. Inflation is a problem that is felt the most at heart. It's felt the most by Tom, Dick, and Mary because, as we know now, when you go to the grocery store and spend a lot more money, or when you go to the gas pump and spend a lot more money, it hurts. Inflation is felt very, very hard by people who own assets, because when inflation goes up, the price, the amount of wealth they have can be halved. But you know what? Half of really, really wealthy is still really wealthy. And so they don't experience pain. They just experience discomfort.
Yeah.
Okay? Pain is experienced by Tom, Dick, and Mary. And so the problem with inflation is the solution to inflation tends to be to inflict even more pain on Tom, Dick, and Mary to avoid them having increased wages.
All right. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. That's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, the most powerful man in the world contracted COVID. And I don't know, this is his first time, I think. Yeah, it's Joe Biden's first time having COVID, and he's got a runny nose, they said, and I don't know if they said sore throat or not.
I think they said a slight cough.
Slight cough, yeah, dry hacking kind of cough.
Yeah.
And the most powerful man on earth can contract COVID. That means all of us at some point in time are probably going to contract COVID.
You know, I think they think that all of us maybe have, almost all of us have had it, because I think the number of people who have officially had it is like 75 million or some such number. But, you know, I had it. But I had it, and I took a home test, and that's what proved I had it.
I took a home test.
I didn't report the positive result to anybody, so I'm not one of those 75 million, and either are you. And so the fact is that the number who've actually had it is far greater than 75 million. And they're thinking it's probably double that number, because not only are there people like you and I who took home tests who know we had it but didn't report it to anybody, so the government doesn't know we had it, but there are people who had it who don't even know they ever had it.
Right.
I mean, my COVID was a runny nose and laryngitis. And I guarantee you, in 1998, when I was working and whatever, I would have gone to work every day. I wasn't sick.
Right.
I wasn't sick enough to stay home. I would have taken whatever I had to work. And the shame on me for that, but that was normal behavior back then. So there's lots of people who have been sick like that and didn't get tested, don't know. So it could well be that 200 million people have had it, you know, which is pretty damn near everybody.
Sandy, that's kind of what I believe.
Yeah.
That people have had it, did not know at all that they've had it. And you know, many of us, it's had some long-lasting impact or effect. My taste buds, man, I really can't taste food.
Yeah.
I really can't smell.
Well, people have long said you were tasteless. And a man without taste, I didn't know.
So, Sandy, have you taken a look at the kind of tennis shoes that I wear? And you're telling me tasteless?
No, you're stylish. You are a man of high style. I have ringing in my ears.
I'm telling you, I even when I'm cooking,
yeah,
I'm like, man, I can't smell the food.
Yeah. So I mean, that's the issue with the difference between a cold and COVID, or the flu and COVID, is we haven't really figured out all of the facets of what COVID can do to you. So, you know, in many respects, when I had that slight sore throat, laryngitis, and runny nose, it was a very trivial disorder. But if it leaves me with some long-term effect, then it's a little less trivial. I mean,
right.
If it's only a ringing in my ear, okay, I've got a ringing in my ear. But if it's something else, if it's myocarditis or some of the other side effects that people have talked about, then it's a little more serious. So I think COVID's going to continue to be treated as a disease that's not quite just a common cold. But it's definitely on the verge of becoming endemic.
So let's look at, if you look at the map, it's really spreading like wildfire, but there's no panic this time, right?
Yeah.
People aren't, I got to get inside,
Well, I think the disease is more trivial now. I mean, I think it has morphed into something, this new Omicron virus, BN, or
right.
Whatever the...
B5.
Whatever it is clearly one that's maybe more transmissible but much more benign than the original coronavirus that was really... And so you can see that because the rate of hospitalizations per person testing positive has gone way down. So people are not getting as sick. And I think the reason we aren't panicking, number one, is a bunch of us have had it and it's like no big deal. Number two, the hospitals are not in a state of being overwhelmed. And from the standpoint of public health and the public health interest, it's really all about, are our hospitals overwhelmed or not?
So only 35%. Even though they say 65 million Americans have been vaccinated, 65% of Americans have been vaccinated for COVID, but only 35% have gotten the additional boosters.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of them until Wednesday of this week when I finally said, hey, if I got the two original Moderna shots, vaccinations, why have I dragged my feet on the boosters?
Yeah.
And it finally dawned on me that doesn't make any sense. So I finally went in and got a booster, but there was something that was going on in my mind that was, even though I got the first COVID shots, I saw all these people dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be one of them. And once I got the vaccinations and you saw that portion of it has faded away, and Sandy, maybe as you stated, maybe never to come back again to that degree, you know, because things have changed and the immunity of people have grown. And then I asked myself, well, why would I keep getting these the booster shots?
Yeah.
But then I said, hey, I'm around a lot of people. I'm around a lot of, why would I not? And that was what finally made me decide, hey, what have you been thinking? Go on and get the booster shot. And I went in and got the booster shot. Guess what? Nothing changed. My appetite didn't change. I didn't get sick. Nothing changed. There was nothing to fear. It was never a matter of me fearing that I would feel ill or something from getting the booster. It was just, I call it stinking thinking. That you're listening to some things that, and instead of you doing the reasoning and rationale yourself, you can kind of get caught up in that. Well, why do they keep sending? How many more of these boosters am I going to have to take? I had two.
Well, it is true. I think that they keep talking about evolving the boosters and trying to make them address the most recent strains, the most recent variants. I don't know. I think that the vaccination movement was an important one, and I think it was important in the United States to try and address the pandemic as it originated, yeah. And it was important to mitigate the severity of the disease. So, I think the governments have to do a far better job of both messaging and understanding themselves the reasoning behind the vaccination movements. You know, just yesterday, apparently, the first American in a long time was diagnosed with polio.
Yeah, yeah.
It was someone who had not been vaccinated against polio. The public health announcement that was talking about it pointed out that polio vaccinations were required for children to go to school.
Right.
Which was the same as the smallpox vaccination. So, I mean, I think important, dangerous diseases that can be treated by vaccination, there's a very powerful public policy argument for making sure that vaccinations occur. And I would just simply go back to the fact that I think the whole public messaging, and I would fault the Trump administration in large part for this, the public messaging relating to vaccination, but it occurred across the world, was just very, very poorly handled.
You know, then this fringe monkeypox shows up, and now another reason for people to say, monkeypox? Do I need to get a vaccination for?
Monkeypox strikes me as a disease that's possibly a little bit more like AIDS in terms of the
way it's transmitted for gay people.
So, well, it has to do with body fluids,
right,
and things. So it wouldn't just be gay, but the fact is that it's a disease that undoubtedly is going to be it's going to have a growth pattern that will begin to relate to the general public. I was in Aurora Hospital, St. Luke's, day before yesterday. The fellow I was talking to there was talking about the fact that they're getting alerts for monkeypox all the time, and that as far as the hospitals are concerned, they think it's going to be the next wave in terms of a significant problem.
Wow. You know, Sandy, thanks as always.
Yeah.
See you on Monday.
See, we ended with monkey business. That's the way it goes.
All right. Gotta run. Thank you, Connor, for a great week. Thank everybody who took the time out to listen. It's going to be a great weekend. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.